Welcome to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds, featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I am your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team, here to lead conversations and to shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. I am thrilled to announce our 2025 virtual MTSS Summit happening this December. This two-day event is all about MTSS innovation with intention, where we will dive into bold ideas and practical strategies to ensure every student is supported and every educator is equipped to succeed. Join an international community of educators and leaders to explore how intentionality and innovation can drive meaningful change in MTSS implementation. You won't want to miss this incredible opportunity to connect and grow. Let's be honest, for many district leaders, school safety is absolutely necessary, but it's not always the most celebrated part of their job. And even with all of the joy of working with students, we know that keeping them safe and well is just the top priority. So on today's episode, we've got Dr. Jess Plaza, a district leader from Evanston-Skokie School District in Illinois, and she's here to chat with us about how school safety fits within the MTSS framework. Welcome, Jess.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, Jess, I would love to hear a little bit about your district and what makes your district a great place to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm partial, right? My kids also go to school in the school district, so I can speak to it from a person who works here and as a parent. I think one of the biggest things that I love about our district is that we are a community. We spend a lot of time really talking about and thinking about how do we support everybody in our community, not just from the kids, but also families. How do we partner with community resources that we have in our town, as well as just some different organizations? It's really kind of that focus on being able to wrap around and really support everybody is something that's really special. I think I have not seen that in other districts that I've worked in. And it makes the town of Evanston, we feed in Evanston is a town and Skokie is a town. So we have some kids that live in Skokie as well. So, but being able to really partner together with everybody and really take a holistic view of who our kids are and what our community needs is pretty special for me.
Awesome. I can see how that maybe drew you into the work of MTSS. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's all connected, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, today we are talking about how school safety fits into the multi-tier system of support framework. So can you talk a little bit about why you think it's critical to think about this component as well?
I mean, right, MTSS is a system that guides everything. And so part of your system is being able to make sure that you have a safe environment for a positive learning climate and culture. You know, you have to make sure that kids feel like they belong, that they feel safe in the space that they're in. And they spend quite a few hours every day, as well as thinking about how does your staff and the people that work in your system interact with that. And so for us, it's really about, right, like that tier one, how do we create the safe environment for everybody? What are the explicit expectations, instructions that we offer? And then, you know, we have kids who do struggle, right? And so how do we make sure that we keep the safety of everybody at the core of what we're doing and then figure out when kids do have a hard time, how do we provide different interventions and supports to allow them to still access a safe environment, but then perhaps help them when sometimes the things that they are doing are unexpected and create spaces where people might feel uncomfortable or unsafe. So it's really about like the whole system and the range, not just in tier one, but tier two and tier three as well.
Yeah. Well, and you know, when you think about school safety, I mean, I think lots of things come to mind when we say that word, right? The physical safety of a school, right? You know, I know that that's lots of news stories around that right now, sadly, but also creating that environment for students to feel psychologically safe and emotionally safe and those kind of things. Do you feel like that there's a certain aspect of any of those that's like the hardest to address?
The hardest, I think, is probably the emotional and psychological safety. physical safety, you know, everybody is really clear, right? Like we have exit signs, that we have the doors that lock, we have the doorbell. Like those are some of the things that are easy to make sure that we implement in every space. But when we're talking about emotional safety and psychological safety, it's so different depending on each individual person and what their personal life experiences are. Something that can make me feel safe might not be what makes somebody else feel safe. And so being able to really dig in and ask kids and grownups, like, what are things that make you feel emotionally safe, that make you feel psychologically safe, or things that don't, and really then being able to build up those resources and supports, I think is probably some of the hardest things, right? Because it's not as cut and dry as it is with the door always locks behind you. And we all have badges that we wear to walk into a school. And so that's, I think, sometimes where we have to put in some extra work and attention.
Yeah. And I think that that's the aspect of school safety that I think gets kind of muddy for many educators, mm-hmm. because understanding psychological safety in general, yeah. I think is hard for students and hard for adults. A lot of adults don't understand, I react this way because I don't feel safe.
Correct. Like, yep. And recognizing that when you are dysregulated yourself, that, and you're a person that's standing in front of children, right? Like the children pick up on that. And so being able to really know yourself as much as you know the people around you it's tricky, especially when you don't always recognize when you yourself are dysregulated.
Yeah. You know, if I could go back to myself as a 23-year-old teacher, there's a lot of things because in my own learning of myself, I recognize different moments where, yes. I was dysregulated. Mm-hmm. And that's why that student could just press my buttons more.
Right. Or maybe that's why they reacted in that way. Right.
So, yeah.
Right. They were responding to my initial response. Right. Like, I've had to learn that as a parent as much as I have as an educator. And so, yeah, it's definitely, and I would say too, like, we don't spend a lot of, and I mean, I've been in education for a while, but most of my learning how to be a teacher did not involve learning about things about emotional and psychological well-being. It was, this is how you teach math. This is how you teach reading. And we missed some of that learning to be able to be prepared to teach the children that we're in front of now.
Well, and I also think that there's an aspect of learning and teaching those things. Like we said, we have to understand them ourselves, mm-hmm. and understand how, you know, understanding how the brain works. And we talked, I've had a guest on the podcast in the past year and talked about how, like, emotions can mirror each other, and mm-hmm. how often in a classroom, if you're dysregulated, it's more often, you know, the student can be dysregulated or vice mm-hmm. versa. They can have that impact on yourself. And so understanding some of those things, I think we've learned a lot in the last 10, 15 years about how the brain works and how certain things impact our environment and our emotions. So mm-hmm. I would love to talk a little bit about, especially when it comes to addressing, you know, issues of school student safety, what are some key differences between that proactive and reactive approaches that we often see? Like, why is it important to prioritize prevention over maybe mm-hmm. punishment?
Well, and so I was a principal for about 10 years before moving into the district office. And what I used to always tell the kids that I supported and my educators was that school should be the most predictable place that you're going to find, right? We need to have structures and routines and clear expectations, which is the proactive piece, because there's always going to be something that happens that takes us by surprise, always. But if we know what we need to do and how we need to respond in different moments and in different ways, we are then able to react in a calmer and more targeted way. And so for me, it's really about thinking about what are the tools and resources and the patterns and trends we might see in our data or anecdotally that we know, okay, these are some things that the people in our community, the kids, the adults maybe are struggling with. How do we address them ahead of time so that we don't have to react as urgently when something pops up, right? And so really thinking about, in my mind, when we do have moments where a child will become dysregulated, right? You might have to have the kids leave a classroom. You might have to let families know, hey, this was the incident that happened at recess, right? When you have to go into those spaces and places, you need to be able to fall back on this is the routine that we have in place always. We've taught the kids, we've reiterated it, we've provided support if you struggle with the routine. This is how we talk about what respect is or responsibility, right? And so when you have those proactive pieces in place, it's not necessarily then a punishment when you have to react to something. It's I need to reteach you because that learning has not become generalized enough for you to be able to function. And also understand and recognize that all of us get dysregulated. We all do unexpected things sometimes. That doesn't mean I need to be punished for it. That typically means I need to be taught a different way to manage my emotions or my responses to stressful situations. And so we spend a lot of time really thinking about what are the restorative pieces that we can do so that when it happens, because it will, we know how to react, but we proactively plan that reaction, right? Like we know what team to call, we know what adult to call for support, we know what we're going to do if this type of incident happens, so that it kind of then allows us to stay hyper-focused on the mistake that happened and really think about how do we repair the harm that was caused.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. Having those systems and structures in place beforehand, sort of not saying, oh, wow, we had this unexpected, not being shocked by a student being dysregulated. It's almost one of those things where if you're thinking about, I always thought, you know, that there was always an uptick of behavior from our data, of behavior on the Friday before Halloween or something like that. We knew that that was an issue. So if you're thinking through that direction, what can we put into place beforehand or what skill could we teach students or what procedure or routine can we put in place to mitigate some of those issues that we've had in the past? So I think I like how you talked about that of using what you know, your data to put into those routines and procedures. Yep. And I think you're right. The more structure and the more expected things that are happening in schools, the more likely that you'll kind of mitigate some of that dysregulation. Because I mean, I think especially young students, the more more structured things are, the more safe they feel. They know what to expect.
Yeah. Well, it kind of goes back to that brain research you were talking about. We know that when we are able to keep things where they are expected and the person's brain is not waiting for something unexpected to happen all the time because they always know when I walk in at 9:05, this is going to be the thing that I experience. And then I know next is math, right? Like when you have that consistent routine, it helps diminish that urge to have the fight or flight, right? And you have the psychological safety of knowing this is always going to be my routine. You know, sometimes the routine doesn't always happen that way. And you have to be able to front load for some kids like, hey, today's going to look different. But you've got to be able to create that just and it builds in that pathway in their brain so that they understand this is how this is going to go so that it helps them stay more regulated.
And I even want to go back to even having those protocols for when something does happen. That even I think is helpful for teachers, creating a sort of safety for teachers, knowing how to react in those moments, what to do if this happens with a student. You say this, have the students leave the class, you know, all of those kind of procedures are really helpful because I've been in situations where like a student reacts in a huge way and I don't have that training or those procedures behind it. And that's really scary to know. I need to know the right decision. And so I think that having that is a great way of creating safety for your adults as well. Mm-hmm.
Yes, very much so. Right. And practicing it with them, not just saying, here it is. Right? Because in the moment, you're probably not going to remember. So like building in those opportunities as a building educator community of, hey, this is how we respond to things. Let's practice it and talk through it so that when it does happen, you can respond with more automaticity instead of also kind of worrying and not necessarily knowing what to do.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm curious about sort of what challenges or even growing pains did your district face as you kind of implemented some of these protocols, within the MTSS framework?
You know, I think there's a few, right? I think a big one for us is that when we start really talking about threat assessments or being able to decipher, like, what kind of response do we need to happen, it became, hey, we're going to do this. But in hindsight, being able to really reflect, did we give people enough common language and understanding about this is what a threat is. And it could be a threat towards others, or it could be a threat towards self. And when you receive those, we can't just necessarily say, oh, I know them, they didn't mean it, right? And really start building that system of, if you hear a threat of harm to self or to others, you take it seriously every time. But then also helping teach our kids that too, right? Because sometimes kids will say things and it's because they're angry or they're upset. And then how do we help teach them? Like, when you say these types of things, these are serious and we will always respond this way, so that they can help start better understanding, I think. So that was one of ours. I think the other piece is really just kind of trying to figure out how to balance confidentiality with the need to provide consistent support, right? So not everything a child shares needs to be shared with everybody, but what is the thing that needs to be shared so that it doesn't matter where that child moves in your school? Every adult that is there to support them knows, I have to be able to say this when this child tells me X, right? And so being able to get a lot more clear on that. And part of it's been working with our social workers and our, you know, we're a pre-K 8 building, so our school district, I'm sorry. And so part of it, it's like having that conversation with our social workers. We have counselors in our middle school of like, what actually needs to be super confidential and what can be more globally shared. I think we're still trying to balance that and really figure that out.
I think that honestly, that's a age-old problem. You know, I feel like there's always this tricky balance of providing context and understanding, but also, you know, respecting the confidentiality. I think that it's so hard. And I've worked with teachers who are like, why didn't you just tell us everything? I was like, but that's, you know, we have to be respectful of the situation. And you don't all need to know all the information in order to do your job. But I've been on the other side of it. That's like, you feel like you're missing a piece, but it's also important to
And that's where the team comes in, right? And so trying to really figure out, which I would say is something like that's still a little bit of a growing pain for us, is like, who is the team in each building? Not necessarily, you know, it needs to be more than one or two people, but like, who is the team so that when it's time to share information or when it's time to start looking at the data and thinking about what do these threat and risk assessments tell us about some patterns and trends in our building? You've got to have a team of people that have different perspectives, right? Like, you need to be able to pull in a perspective of a paraprofessional or a support person, because the way that they interact with children is very different than the principal versus the PE teacher. And so really thinking about who needs to be on that team and how often do you need to talk and meet has been something that a lot of our schools have it down pretty solid, but it took us a minute to kind of get there and really think about like, who do we need to involve and what do they actually need to be working through in addition to responding to when there needs to be some additional support, right? When you get the call, who are the people that can respond to it? But also then who are the people that help you look at the data to help you be proactive in your planning?
So tell us a little bit more about your specific teams. I know that this kind of practical advice is really helpful for school leaders of like, okay, what role do they really play in sort of integrating threat assessments and in MTSS?
So every building's a little bit different. I would say our recommendation in our district is obviously the school leader is on the team. Doesn't mean the school leader is leading the team, but they are on the team. Typically the social worker, psychologist, because we use our social workers, psychologists, and our middle school, our counselors, they are the ones that actually do the threat and risk assessment because they've had the additional training, and are considered mental health professionals, right? So like, they do the actual assessments for us, but then we also have classroom educators. You might be a special education teacher. You might be a general education. You might be a multilingual teacher. And then we try for paraprofessionals too. Most of the paraprofessionals we have in our school district are tied to students with an IEP. And so being able to kind of use their lens, because again, they work with kids in a very different way. The whole team is expected to meet at least monthly. Most of our schools meet probably twice a month. The whole team is really responsible for looking at like climate and safety MTSS for the entire building. How many calls are we getting? If there is, you know, if we need to react to a student, how many team calls are we getting to come and respond to a situation? How many threat and risk assessments have we had this month? Do these students have an SEL MTSS plan or not? Do they need one? You know, you might be the point person that's assigned to support that kid for a check-in, check-out. And then we have, on a daily basis, our schools have kind of like a rotation. So on Monday, I'm the person that will have the walkie-talkie with two other people maybe. And if there is a call that is needed for support in a classroom, I come. And then on Tuesday, it's two or three other people. And then Wednesday, it might be me again and somebody else. But we try to break it up so it's not always the same people on call every single time. And then those are my people that will come if there needs to be a threat or a risk assessment done. They'll come. They'll meet together really quick. What path do we need to take? Okay, you're going to go do this while you're doing the questions of the actual assessment process. I'm going to look at the data that we have on the child, behavior incident referrals, attendance, any past issues that we know of, so that when we come together to talk about the situation, we're able to make a clear determination based on multiple pieces of information. And then we leverage that team as well throughout the school year to help do some professional learning with the rest of their staff. So when we say we need to practice drills, here's why we need to practice them. And they provide some anecdotal support or small group support to different educators and groups, depending on the building. And then we do training with them throughout the summer and the school year as well, just to make sure that, you know, the different teams are functioning the way they need to function. We take feedback. How do we need to improve? And then, so like my role at the district level is to provide kind of that consulting. Mm-hmm. Principal says, hey, here's how our team is working. Here's what we've noticed. We're still struggling with X. And then I can help step in with some of my counterparts to really think about like, well, have you thought about it in this way? And this school does it really well because we have 18 schools in our district. You might want to go talk to that school leader and see if they can give you some additional support. Because they're the ones that are doing it every day, right? And they know a little bit more practical than I do sometimes what needs to happen.
Yeah. Can you share maybe if you have an example or anything that comes to mind about how the proactive approach has really helped, or early intervention has really helped prevent crisis in your district?
I mean, I think we have two. I think the first thing that we've done is we have actually been using SEL screener data for a few years now. We started off using the DESA mini survey for our kids, and we've transitioned into using SABRES, which gives us just a little bit more information. And we do SEL screeners 2 times a year. So we wait for them to kind of get settled, right? Because it takes a minute for everybody to get settled. So we usually do it November, December, and then we do it again in the spring. But we use that to help us identify specific kids. The assessment tool that we use, SABRES, has a teacher response, and then it has a student response for kids second through eighth grade. And so we can compare the data about what the child is saying they need versus what the teacher is saying that they need. And that helps us do like our first initial run through of like who might need some additional help. And we use that then with our teams to say, okay, Jess's name has come into the conversation a few times. What's the intervention planning and support that we're offering Jess, so that we can help minimize, some of the responses or reactions that she might be happening. And then we also have a tier one SEL program for all grades, pre-K through eighth grade. It's taught once a week. But it really focuses on how do we level set some of the language and understanding of different SEL needs that we have in our school. So when, like I mentioned it before, when I'm saying respect, this is the definition of respect that we have across our district. And so it helps really kind of keep that consistency and system for all of our buildings so that we're really clear on what we're talking about. And then we're able to give age-appropriate direct instruction so that when we do have kids that we say, hey, this child needs more help, we already have tier one instruction happening, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have kids that are like, oh, they need all of these services right away, but we've not done anything in tier one yet for them. And we have to address that first before we ramp it all the way up to most intensive support. And so that's been a proactive thing that we've had in place for the last couple of years, 2 years, to be able to really make sure every child is getting tier one instruction, so that when we are ready to provide some additional support for kids, we are then able to say, okay, here's what we have to do at tier two or tier three, or if we need to go further.
Yeah. What has the data shown from that? Like, has it found it being effective to mitigate certain issues. Yeah.
So it's interesting. We have found that we have a lot more kids that have a lot clearer understanding, and teachers and families that have a lot clearer understanding of like what the general topics are that we talk about within tier one. And it's now an everybody responsibility, not just some people. And so it's definitely become something that's more of a shared responsibility with everybody in our system instead of just, oh, classroom teacher, this is just what you have to do. We have had a lot more kids that we've been able to identify and actually start talking about in terms of needing SCL MTSS support. You know, in prior years, it was, you know, we would sit down and problem solve when you had like five huge explosions and things like that. So it was a very reactive way of identifying and supporting kids. We've gotten a lot more proactive now, and really thinking about the child is telling us what they need. So like, let's figure out. We also survey our kids twice a year, and we've had an increase for sense of belonging and student engagement over the last couple of years, based off of what our kids are telling us, that like, yes, I feel safe. Yes, I feel like I have a connection with other people and adults in our school, which has been kind of a big focus for us of really making sure we want you to feel like you belong here, but we also want you to feel like you have somebody that you can connect with and talk to. Doesn't have to be your classroom teacher, but it's at least another adult in our system. And so, like I said, we've seen increases in those the last couple of years as well. We've spent a lot of time, a lot of our schools have really gotten into being really intentional about community building activities. So like in middle school, they call them town halls. In our elementary space, it's usually like morning meeting and things like that, but it's really targeted and specific around being able to build a sense of community, connect and have relationships, and pulling some of the responses that kids give us in those surveys to really think about, here's how we want to shift this. We heard you. Here's how we're trying to start shifting this so that it's an environment that you all feel like you belong in and that your voices are important. And so I think those are probably our biggest strategies that I would credit to that.
So, okay, my last question really is, what advice would you give to other, specifically district leaders who are just beginning kind of the work to integrate threat assessments in building their teams into their MTSS frameworks or into how the, you know, into their schools?
I mean, I think for me, the biggest takeaway that I have had is that MTSS support for behavior and social emotional needs needs to look the same as it does for academics. I think we are very good in most systems at identifying academic needs. Here's the intervention, here's the cycle, here's the progress monitoring. My realization has been you can do the same thing within the world of SEL MTSS. You just have to use different pieces of data. So use your data from your threat and risk assessments. Use your data from student surveys, from attendance. We look at data from health office visits, right? Like, are there certain kids that are always going to the nurse at 2 o'clock, come to find out they all have math at 2 o'clock, right? And so using, really thinking about what's the data, I think the hardest part, we all get it in education, is that initiative fatigue, right? This is not necessarily something that has to look brand new. You can leverage pieces that you already have in different systems into this. It's just talking about it now. Instead of it being an afterthought, it has equal footing with the academics. And then I think the biggest piece is like, what is the data that you're actually going to look at? You need to know that ahead of time, because oftentimes when it comes to things like threat or risk assessments or behaviors, some people report it, some people don't, some people document interventions and have a lot of information. Other people don't, but you have to know if you're going to use this, you've got to be clear with others. I need this information to help me plan for support for a child. It's not a punishment for a child. This is data collection for us to figure out how to problem solve around this. And so really being clear around what that needs to look like so that everybody is on the same page, right? We still have it. It's still a struggle for us in certain places, right? We'll still have people say, I'm writing you up and you're going to get in trouble, when that's not the point of that. It's really to be able to identify, hey, they're always getting in trouble Friday mornings. What's going on Thursday before they come back to school on Friday, right? And how do we partner and try to figure that out and put some proactive supports in place so that when they come on Friday, they're not having a terrible day, you know? Yeah. And so I think that's really kind of like where we have had to dig in a lot, and be able to think about that. And then leveraging Canopy Case Management for us has been really helpful, because it all lives then in the Branching Minds system, which we already use for our behavioral incident referrals. We already use it for our MTSS plans. And so for us, keeping it as easy and centralized as possible has been, you know, it's very hard when you have to go to five different places to do one job. And so that's been pretty important for us as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here to chat about school safety and all the kinds of things with, especially within MTSS and all the work that you're doing. It sounds like some great things are happening and you're just helping support kids. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what matters, right? Making sure that kids feel safe and ready to learn.
Yep, absolutely.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to School and Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds. Go ahead and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget, if you are enjoying our content, would you do us a favor and rate and review our podcast on iTunes? This helps others find our podcast and lets us know how much you love what we're creating. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To learn more about us, check out our website, branchingminds.com, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn at Branching Minds.